Welcome to West End United Methodist Church's midweek hybrid program, Centering Your Week. My name is Reverend Brandon Baxter, and I am one of the associate pastors here at West End United Methodist Church. Uh-oh. Hold on one second. Part of the hybrid experience is that sometimes we hear other devices playing the sound that we have going, and so my computer was turned up, and I was wondering where the echo was coming from. It's good to see you this evening, and we are at the end of the month of September, and as I have explained each week that we've met so far for this experiment in September, we are going through a rotation of four different themes each month, and we will revisit those themes time and again. In a few moments, we will be hearing from the Reverend Dr. Bruce Rogers Vaughn as he talks to us a bit about grief in this, what are you calling it, the Great Interruption?
The Great Interruption.
And so we're going to talk a little bit about what's been happening over these last 18 months and how people are feeling and processing this, and also the impacts it's had on the world around us, and maybe some ways we can start to grapple with all of that. Next week, we'll start the cycle over again, and so we'll be back into the Word. We're doing Word, Wisdom, Wonder, and Way each month. And so next week, I will take us through an exploration of the first half of the book of Mark and look at some of the verses that we're going to be focusing on out of the book of Mark in chapters 9 and 10 over the course of this next month in our worship services. And then following that, in the coming weeks, we will have an interview with Susan Adcock here. Pastor Stacy will be here that second week in October, and she will interview Susan about the outreach work that she does partially on our behalf with persons experiencing homelessness in Nashville, and she works through Open Table. So you can hear her. And then the third week on Wisdom, we're going to have Sally Honor here, and she's going to talk to us some about what it is to have a life of centering prayer. So we experienced Vespers with Alan Whitley last week. Sally's going to help take us on a journey of what it means to center. And then finally, at the back end of the month, we're going to hear from Lindsay Crinks, who has written a book called Praying with Our Feet. And she's going to do a book chat about that book and talk about her experiences working with the unhoused here in Nashville. So without further ado, I'm going to turn this presentation tonight and this experience over to Bruce. And I'll let Bruce introduce himself in whatever way he chooses. So Bruce,
thanks,
you've got
Brandon.
The floor.
I wasn't thinking about introducing myself other than saying my name, but I'm Bruce Rogers Vaughn. I've been teaching. Actually, I've lived in the Nashville area since 1983. I moved here to start out on a PhD at Vanderbilt University, stayed on, taught at Vanderbilt Divinity School for 23 years. I've also been a pastoral psychotherapist here in the Nashville area for over 30 years now, so I can't believe I've been around here this long. But I do want to jump right into the material for tonight, so just I would like to leave some opportunity for questions if there are questions toward the end. And I think, Brandon, you wanted me to say that folks online, if they have questions, can phone it in or whatever they want to do.
Put it in the chat,
however you want to get it to us, and we'll try to answer some of those either during the presentation or toward the end. So I can be interrupted, Brandon, by the way, if a question comes up that pertains to something I'm saying at the moment. So I've titled this talk, Grief and Mental Health During the Great Interruption. And I'm going to be looking at the screen because the glasses I have will not work looking at my laptop. So pardon my looking back and forth. Grief and Mental Health During the Great Interruption. I'm calling this the Great Interruption because of how much it's interrupted our lives. It's interrupted our individual lives. It's interrupted in particular our collective lives, so our lives as families, our lives as communities, of course as congregations, and it's interrupted our national life, our life as a society. And I'm going to talk about an aspect of this interruption, though, that is not talked about that much, although there is a lot of data that's now beginning to be accumulated about mental health as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. We hear mostly talk about how many cases, I mean, listening to the news every day, whether it's on social media, television, or whatever source you happen to use, we're hearing a lot more about the number of deaths, the number of cases. We hear a lot of talk about masks or no masks. We hear talk about vaccines. And we hear a lot of racket about the politicization of all those things. We even hear quite a bit about the economic impact of COVID-19. What we're not talking a great deal about is its effect on our mental health, including our grieving, our capacity to grieve. So that's my focus for this evening. And I'm going to try to break this down kind of in two ways. I'm going to talk about the direct impact of the pandemic on grief and mental health, and then talk about the indirect impact. Those are probably not good terms. What I really mean by that is the impacts that are obvious, the ones we talk most about, and the ones that we're not talking as much about that are impacting our grieving and our mental health probably just as much as the ones in the headlines. So first, the direct impact, the obvious things that we would talk about, have to do with grief that is due to the accumulating deaths due to the pandemic, to other losses related to COVID-19, which I'll mention a few in a moment, and also, of course, isolation, which is a huge factor that's affecting the way we're grieving and also, as a result, our mental health. This is a map as recently, I think that data is maybe only 4 days old. On the map, the darker colors are the number of deaths, the states where the most deaths have occurred. The lighter colors where the fewest deaths have occurred. I went online today to the dashboard for COVID to get updated numbers. So these numbers are updated as of yesterday. So far there have been 693,000 deaths from COVID-19. And that's up quite a bit, I think, from the day before, probably 4,000 or 5,000 people. So I think we're unfortunately going to pass 700,000 probably before this weekend. Sociologists tell us that the average number of intimate people around each death, by intimates they mean family members and very close friends. So those most impacted by a death are average around 9 people. So if we multiply the number of COVID deaths by 9, we get about 6.25 million people who have been directly impacted by a death due to COVID. As of the first of last week, COVID-19 is now the greatest pandemic in recent U.S. history. It passed the number of deaths that occurred in the 1918 flu epidemic about 10 days ago. Now I'm going to pause on this screen. First, I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to share a few things in relation to it. This is a researcher named Sherman Lee from Christopher Newport University who has been studying the emotional fallout from COVID-19, from the pandemic, and he said this recently. There's a tsunami of bereavement and grief happening, and it's not even normal grief, but traumatic grief. They've had their worlds rocked without the usual things we can grab onto to cope. And he concluded, 2/3 are suffering from dysfunctional grief, so bad that they're impaired by it. That's in the clinical range, in need of professional medical support. So it says basically this is the difference between a bruise and a broken bone. This is very critical to understand. So the previous slide, when I just talked about the number of raw deaths and how many people were directly impacted by those deaths, it doesn't account for the context in which these deaths are occurring, which is isolations, shutdowns, lack of community support, which, as you know, is affecting even our churches. So the result of that is people are grieving in isolation. They're grieving alone or with just a very small handful of people around them. I want to share three short stories, very short stories, just citations basically, of cases I'm working with directly to give examples of this and how it goes beyond even deaths that are directly due to COVID. I'm seeing a person, several people actually, who've had people die during the pandemic, not all due to COVID. The person I'm thinking about now had a parent die several months ago during the pandemic. And when she attended the funeral was at the graveside, and only five people were present. Herself, three family members, and the minister. That was it. And there's been thousands of funerals like this across the United States during the pandemic. Now, please understand, her mother did not die from COVID. Her mother died of other causes. And yet, because of the COVID pandemic, she is not able to grieve and be supported. And today, she's in a clinical state of depression, impaired in some of the ways this researcher is talking about. I'll mention another example slightly related to that. One of my clients in the past year was a physician in an emergency room outside of this state, actually. In the age of telehealth, I'm seeing a lot of people online that are not restricted to the Nashville area. He had a death in his ER not long ago. That was a man who was an employee of the hospital where he worked in the ER. The man had had a surgery for a bleed, an internal bleed, about 2 weeks prior to his death. He was doing so well, he had returned to work. And at work one day, he collapsed, ended up in this man's ER, where they discovered his sutures internally had broken apart, and he was hemorrhaging internally. The hospital did not have the kind of surgeon or capacity to do the surgery to fix the bleeding. So he called the hospital where the surgery was originally done and asked to Metaflight him there. The answer he got on the phone is, we don't have any beds and we don't have the personnel to do the surgery. He said to the person, well, this man is going to die. Lying in my ER. The man on the other end said, let me call you back. About 15 minutes later, he called back and he said, I think we can do this. A helicopter is on the way. As the helicopter was landing, the man had a cardiac arrest and died. So I was talking to this doctor over telehealth, and he said to me, this man died on my watch, unnecessarily. And he said he did not die of COVID. He died because of COVID. In other words, because of COVID, there simply wasn't adequate personnel or care for the man to get. The third one I'm going to mention briefly is has to do with me. So about 3 weeks ago, and I found this out on Facebook, a longtime dear friend, another pastoral counselor actually, who used to live here in Nashville, he's been a friend of mine for at least three decades, killed himself. I was stunned. All of us who knew him were stunned. He lived in New Orleans. Here again, the family decided that only the immediate family would be at the funeral. And even if they had opened it up, given the Delta wave we're going through now, I doubt that I would have gotten on a plane and flown down there. So I'm experiencing this myself, the kind of isolation from no way to really process losses like this with other people who share that loss. This makes sense, right? It's having a devastating effect, not just on our grieving, but on our mental health as this weighs upon us. So now the indirect impact. There's a few people here in the theater, some who've had me as a student before, who are not going to be surprised by where I'm going next. And that's the economic devastation and increasing inequality that is a result of the pandemic, believe it or not. The United States was already in a situation of terrible economic inequality, the worst we've ever had since the Great Depression. And that was before the pandemic hit. Now I'm going to show you some slides about what has happened since. In other words, the United States had pre-existing conditions before the pandemic hit. And now we're seeing this on top of what we already had. This book came out just earlier this month. All my material is fresh, keeping it promising it's fresh. This book came out, I think, September the 7th. Adam Tooze had previously written a book on the recession of 2008 that won a prize. And this book is worth a look. So he's looking at how COVID has affected the world economy. In an interview that he gave a few days ago, he said, "We also gave out lots of money." He's talking about the United States, the U.S. government to be exact. "We gave out lots of money to badly off Americans who desperately needed it." So that was the innovative element. So that's what we saw, was, you know, households getting checks, like most of you probably got checks. But he said the entire spending package, especially in 2020 itself, was explicitly conservative. It was about maintaining the existing order because no one wants the blame for what had happened. It supercharged the rebound of the financial market, handing literally trillions of dollars to better off members of American society. This is what's been going on behind the scenes. And it's not even just from the government, which I'll get to in a minute. This paper, I mean, who reads stuff from the website of the Board of Governors, the Federal Reserve? I do. This man, Jeremy Rood, is a senior economist, has been at the Federal Reserve for about 21 years. He published this paper because he was tired of hearing people talk about, we can't continue to support people and give handouts because it's going to cause inflation. So I'm not going to talk about the paper. I'm going to talk about what he wrote on a footnote on the first page of the paper. Now keep in mind, this is a man who works for the Federal Reserve, is a senior economist, and he writes this. "I leave aside the deeper concern that the primary role of mainstream economics in our society is to provide an apologetics," sounds theological, right? "Is to provide an apologetics for a criminally oppressive, unsustainable, and unjust social order." This is from the Federal Reserve. He's saying that in the United States, we have a criminally oppressive, unsustainable, unjust social order. So then COVID happens. This is a graphic of what happened to three of the most famous world markets: the Nikkei, the Dow Jones, and the FTSE. The FTSE's in London, the Nikkei's in Japan. What happened in the first few months after COVID hit? We heard all about this, right, on television, radio, online. The Dow Jones average went down 35% just in a few weeks after the lockdown occurred in 2020. But then it began to recover, but not much, before July. And what happened after that? You want to guess? Maybe you've already read. This happened. I'm not sure my pointer is working, but okay, you see my arrow? I drew a little blue circle right there around the data that previous slide showed you. So look what has happened to the Dow. See if I can get my arrow back again. To the Dow since then. It's blasted off. So prior to COVID, it was averaging around 28, 29,000 shares. Now it's up to basically 35,000 shares. Can you imagine the money we're talking about? This is how well the well-off in the United States are doing during the pandemic. And by the well-off, I'm saying approximately the top 10% of wage earners in the country. So how is that happening? I forgot to stay in the light, Brandon. I have just a little wiggle room here. How is that happening? Have you all heard the obscure phrase, quantitative easing? You've heard that phrase. Hardly anybody defines it. Here's what quantitative easing is. Most people think that QE is the Federal Reserve handing out free money to banks so that we have more money in our money supply. That's not how it happens. How it happens is the Federal Reserve actually purchases corporate bonds, including the bonds sold by banks. If you know what a bond is an IOU. It's a loan. So this money has to be paid back eventually, supposedly, unless you're really rich and it doesn't have to be paid back. But anyway, what the Federal Reserve does, it goes and buys corporate bonds. So this man is saying, this is about a few months after the lockdown occurred. On 23rd of March, the Federal Reserve announced it would buy investment-grade corporate bonds in order to limit deterioration of corporate financing conditions in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Federal Reserve has never, ever in its history, since 1913 when it was founded, bought so many corporate bonds. It basically owns high percentages of all the major U.S. corporations and banks right now are owed to the Federal Reserve. That's why the Dow Jones blasted off. And that money was not included in the handouts, the several trillion dollar package the U.S. government passed. This was about $5, $6, $7 trillion on top of that money that was given exclusively to wealthy shareholders. Fascinating. This graphic just came out a few days ago. This shows the wealth of billionaires in the United States and how it has increased during the pandemic. So the total bar all the way to the orange top shows from the onset in March until middle of August. We're seeing an increase from about $3 trillion to about $4.75 trillion. So about $1.75 trillion, not billion, trillion dollars has gone into the pockets of billionaires in the United States during the COVID pandemic. Now you may ask yourself, as I did today, how many billionaires are there in the United States? Well, there's about 725. So Brandon, how many people can sit in the sanctuary of West End United Methodist? There you go. So you could comfortably, and have room left, seat all the billionaires in the United States in the sanctuary of West End Methodist Church. Those 725 people made $1.75 trillion personally since the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And the orange bars you see, won't even get to that, are just five individuals, all of them white men. Not surprisingly, five men increased that much wealth on the orange bars. This is about a year before. It's the same principle. Since the onset of COVID, from March to August, the wealth of the 12 richest people grew 40%. They are now collectively worth, and this is the top 12 people in the United States, $1 trillion. Which is greater than the GDP of Belgium and Austria combined. So now we've added another $0.75 trillion on top of that. I don't know. So we would have to add some more countries for that to be equivalent. I said something before about U.S. having pre-existing conditions. This source said it best back in September of 2020, not long after COVID started. Like many of the virus's hardest hit victims, the U.S. went into COVID-19 pandemic racked by pre-existing conditions, fraying public health infrastructure, inadequate medical supplies, a terrible health insurance system. These and other afflictions contributed to the death toll. So we would have had fewer deaths, circling back to my first slides, if we were more prepared and had the infrastructure that we really needed. But in addressing the causes and consequences of this pandemic, the elephant in the room, he says, is extreme income inequality. The author goes on and talks about what's on the graph. The graph compares 1975 with 2018, which was before the pandemic started, mind you. So this is the pre-existing condition he's talking about. So the gray in the bars is the bottom 90% of wage earners in the United States. The bottom 90%. The top, the orange and the blue, are the top 10% wage earners. So we see from 1975 to 2018, the bottom 90% held 7%, thank my eyes. The 67% of the wealth in the U.S. was held by the bottom 90%. By 2018, it was only 50%. And that is a transfer of wealth, if you see on his, of $50 trillion. So we say in the United States we're not for wealth redistribution. That would be communism. Well, we've had wealth distribution for years, and we've been redistributing it upwards. So $50 trillion came out of the pockets of the households of the bottom 90% and went into the pockets of the top 10% over that period of time. So what did COVID do to it? Well, I've already answered my question, I guess, but the graphic I want you to see and get my arrow is right here. You see that? Corresponding to late 2020, that line is almost vertical. That's the top 1% in terms of wealth in the United States, how much their wealth went up since the pandemic hit. That's how much it changed the chart. In what was already, as you see, a radically increasing rate of inequality in the United States. Now, this seems far removed from grief and mental health, but I'm getting there. Give me a moment. Not going to pause much on this slide. This is just showing us the same thing is going on in the whole world. It's not just the U.S. So the line that's in the middle here, you can barely see it on the slide, is the zero mark. So the orange is the workers of the world, the laborers, have lost almost $4 trillion. Lost that money they would have had, they've lost during the pandemic. While the blue, again, we're back to billionaires. The global billionaires have gained that much money during the pandemic on the planet. I'm going to run through some of these real quick. This is not surprising. You've heard these. These are the labor quintiles, showing that low-wage workers have had way more job losses than higher wage earners, not surprisingly. What isn't talked about, we hear every day the unemployment rate. Do you know what the unemployment rate tells you about how the American people are doing? Almost nothing. Why? Because it doesn't count these people. It doesn't count the people who are no longer looking for work, who are no longer in the labor market, which is the pink on this graph, and what has happened since the pandemic began. Millions of people have left the labor market. This is a long view. So this happens to be men. This is only the men in the United States, beginning right after World War II until COVID hit. Right over here, where's my arrow? Right here. This is the number of men who are participating in the labor market. So you see now that it's dropped well below 70%. If we include women and others in this, it goes all the way down to about 63%. Think about that for a minute. Let it sink in. One-third of working-age adults in the United States are unemployed. One-third. Meanwhile, the GDP is going gangbusters. And that very this graph is of the same period of time we just looked at. And at the end, you see what it's done under COVID. The big dip, the crash, was right after COVID hit, followed by the huge upsurge that we talked about earlier. So, what difference does this make? Why am I just going off on a tangent on my favorite topic of neoliberalism and capitalism and income inequality? Well, because it does matter in what's happening with grief and mental health under COVID. And just for a primer of the next two slides I'm going to show you, way back in 2009, Wilson and Pickett, who are in the UK, did a meta-analysis of how does income inequality affect social well-being. This graphic is on how income inequality affects mental health. So what this graph is showing is people with a diagnosable mental illness or addiction and correlating it to how bad the income inequality is. So as you go further to the right are countries with worse income inequality. And you see where the U.S. is? Right there. The worst out of all of these 12 countries, and we have the highest rates of mental illness and addiction as well. So the red line you see is the line of statistical significance. So we already knew that income inequality had a direct impact upon our mental health status as a population. So now let's talk about the data under COVID. And I'm only going to show you two slides on that because I really want this data to sink in. This is fresh. This data is just from a few weeks ago. So on the left, the blue bar is the percentage of adults in the United States diagnosed with either an anxiety disorder or a depressive disorder, and that was from January to June of 2019. So before the pandemic hit, just a few months before the pandemic hit, 11% of adults in the U.S. were diagnosed with either a depressive disorder or an anxiety disorder. Same diagnoses in January 2021, 41.1%. That's a change of 30 points in the percentile increase in depression and anxiety during the COVID pandemic. Any epidemiologist would look at this and swallow their tongues. We've never seen this before. Not in our lifetimes, or your parents' lifetimes, or their parents' parents' lifetimes, or even your great-great-grandparents' lifetimes. We have not seen this before. The next graphic is, this one made me cry even worse. This breaks down those same pandemic-related increases of mental health problems according to age groups. I don't think it requires a lot of interpretation. The bar on the left is adults ages 18 to 24, 56% increase in diagnoses of anxiety and depression. And it stair steps down until adults 65 and older, which is still terrible, by the way. 29% of adults 65 and older, that much increase in depression and anxiety is astonishing. But to think about our young people, 18 to 24, how it's impacted them, who were already precarious because of the lack of living wage jobs out there. This is just amazing. What is the role of the churches? So I'm going to go long on suffering and not much on what do we do about it, okay? I think the churches have to be churches. The churches have to do what they have done best in history, and that is to be genuine communities, genuine face-to-face communities where we care about each other, where we check in on each other, and we support each other. Or as I said in the last chapter of my book, we have to be organic communities that care for souls and amplify hope. And what I mean by souls? By souls, I mean the connective fabric, the fabric that connects us to ourselves, to others, to the community, to society, and to the whole planet, and to the eternal. That connective fabric that relates us all to each other. And it's not just the fabric itself that I refer to as soul. It's living within that network in the posture of love and compassion. That's what soul is. We're living today in one of the most soul-killing environments we have ever lived in the history of the human race, probably. And that's saying a lot. Because at least before this generation, most of us lived in communities. Even way back in ancient times, we lived in tribes. So people had support when they got sick. They had support when someone died. Today, we're so radically individualistic, this support has practically disappeared. So what the churches can do is be churches. We can support one another face to face again. And be, as I say here, spiritually utopian and politically active for the causes of social justice and economic justice. The reason so many young people are leaving the churches today, it's not a lack of PR. It's not a lack of programming. It's not a lack of marketing. It's because churches have become so insensitive and irrelevant. Young people have a great BS detector for slick marketing that is about nothing they care about. So the way the churches in a time of a pandemic like this can recover and get back to what we're doing is by being good face-to-face communities of support. Now, I don't know how I am on the time. I've gone over on the time, Brandon. Are you good? Okay. Do you want to allow anybody to ask a question or... And you can just tell me enough and sit down when we're done.
Does anyone have a question, first of all? I don't have any online yet, but I can think of a couple. Does anybody in here? You have one, Matthew? Here you go.
Yeah, I was wondering how society dealt with the influenza pandemic of 1918. I can't imagine them dealing with it this badly with this much depression, but I could only imagine how bad it was as a percentage of our population. 675,000 people dying of influenza is a greater percentage of the population at that time than this is.
Yes. So
or the Black Death.
Right. So the question is about how would this compare to the great influenza pandemic in 1918? I don't know authoritatively because I'm not an expert on that pandemic, but let me tell you what I do know. I do know that in 1918, we were in what historians call the first Gilded Age in the United States. It also was a period roughly 1880 to 1930, was a time of, again, rapidly increasing inequality. You know, this was the time of Rockefeller and Cornelius Vanderbilt and all the money that was being made by the new billionaires in the United States. So inequality was awful at that time. But what else was going on in that time? You ever heard of the term the social gospel? This was the time that the social gospel was taking over the churches in the United States. And churches were literally out in the streets supporting working people. The churches were backing the people who were suffering, the people on the bottom end of the inequality scale. Now, were the churches, was there controversy? Absolutely, because there were churches that were for rich people as well as the working class. But my point, Matthew, I believe, is your name, right? In answering Matthew's question, my point is it was a terribly different social environment in 1918 during the flu pandemic, and churches were very active in standing up for social justice in the country, mainly through the social gospel movement, which many, many churches, people think, oh, that was just liberals doing that. Oh, heck no, it wasn't. It was just regular churches of working people that were involved in the social gospel, including black churches, which has not often been recognized. So it wasn't just a liberal seminary faculty movement. It was the churches.
I know this is a big question and you can't really answer it, but you could guess at it. Why do you think there is not more, given the facts that you presented and the things that we all know about the way our lives are constructed right now in this society, why is there not more pushback? Why are there not more people gathering to push back against this, yeah, in the streets or on the internet for that? I mean, you know, people are getting on the internet to push back on all sorts of things, but it seems like the heart of the matter doesn't get traction.
With social media, that you could organize people really quickly, and sometimes that has happened. You know, the Arab Spring, which then inspired the Occupy movement, that largely was something that happened over social media, but that has been the outlier. I think what has happened, Brandon, for one thing, is we've been entertained to death. So we've organized this economy from the top, by the way, to entertain people. So it's not only television anymore. It's, you know, it's celebrity worship. It's sports. I'm not against sports. I'm not against celebrities, for that matter. What I'm talking about is a whole social milieu that's preoccupied and obsessed with, you know, chasing rabbits instead of just looking at what is really happening that's affecting their livelihoods and the livelihoods of people they love. So I think that's a name of a book somewhere, Entertained to Death. Kierkegaard actually wrote about this a long time ago, before we had modern technology. He talked about a form of despair that was not aware of itself as being despair. And he said the deepest level of the despair not aware of itself as being despair were people who go along very contentedly in the world thinking everything is fine, being entertained, going, you know, the entertainment of his day. Well, we're doing that today, except on a much larger scale. So most people don't know even some of the stuff that was on the slides that we just talked about a while ago about the United States. Henry Ford Sr. once said, who was a great capitalist, right? Henry Ford Sr. in the first Gilded Age said, if the American people understood how the banking system works, people would be in the streets tomorrow morning. It's truer today than it was when he said it. That's a whole other lecture that I could stand here impromptu and talk about for 2 hours, but I won't. The point is we as churches need to make it our business to learn about these things and talk to one another about it in small groups or even in worship. If we ever read the Hebrew Bible and read the prophets were talking about this stuff. They weren't talking about, oh, you need to read your Bible more every day. You know, you need to go to the synagogue and worship. Well, they weren't against that. But what they were talking about was social justice issues, the issues that affected masses of people. We're not talking about that as much in the churches today, I'm afraid. Some, I mean, I want to give churches their due, but we're relatively quiet.
You said private salvation.
Thank you very much for that term. Yes, so churches have unfortunately bought into, by and large, the individualism of today's culture. So we've kind of prompted people to worry about their individual salvation and not about the salvation of the people. There's a Pan-African term called Ubuntu that is generally translated, I am because we are. So that's a whole different understanding of our individuality rests on the community that births us and supports us instead of taking away our freedom. I mean, geez, folks, I mean, we got people who won't wear masks because they're worried we're taking away their freedom, right? Some of them are my relatives back in Alabama. But it's just such an anti-community understanding of what we should be up to. But thanks for that remark. I know we're over time, Brandon.
No, that's quite all right. I know we are running out of time. I didn't give you a lot of time. You know, we set this series up thinking that we were going to be coinciding with all of our different activities happening on Wednesday nights, and we do have a few folks here tonight, so I really appreciate that, and I appreciate everybody that attended online. This has made me think a lot about what the church and our church needs to be in the next year, and I think it's just starting to dawn on a lot of us, on the ministerial staff and a lot of us as lay people, that maybe we need to really radically rethink some of the things that we focus on for a little while and think about what is most important right now.
What better time than a pandemic,
right? So, well, I appreciate your welcoming us into thinking about these things more deeply. Can people reach out to you in any way if they have questions or would like to?
Turn my mic off and see.
Yeah.
Is it working now?
Yeah, you're on.
I put up this slide because they're welcome to contact me through my website,
okay,
which is simply brucerogersvaughn.com, no spaces, no hyphens, just brucerogersvaughn.com, and they can contact me through the website.
Great. Fantastic.
Okay.
All right. Well, I hope everybody has a good evening, and we hope to see you back next week when we explore a little bit of the book of Mark together. Have a good evening, and we'll see you soon.